Hello and welcome to Game Brain, a board game podcast about our board game group. I'm Ben Mandelker, and joining me, I'm very excited. This week we have from GMT Games, Ken Kuhn. Hey Ken, what's going on?
Hey Ben, I'm just here chatting games, one of my favorite things to do.
Yeah, we're doing a little remote sesh on Zoom. I was not going to let this podcast go dark for a second week in a row. Everyone is busy doing so much, and it was Sunday morning, and I was just like, you know what? Maybe I can like reach out to some people I know through board gaming. And I immediately thought of you because we've had so many fun conversations in the past about gaming. I feel like actually the way we met was so funny because Candace, who's one of the hosts of the show and also has the Board Game Geek podcast, she was like, oh, you and Ken should talk. Ken from GMT Games, because you guys would just love talking about 18XX. And then we got on the phone, or it was during the pandemic, the height of the pandemic. So we got on Discord and we just talked for 90 minutes about 18XX games. It felt like a meeting, but it wasn't a meeting. It was just like two people who'd never met before just talking about 18XX. It was great.
If it was a meeting, it was the most fun meeting.
So tell everyone what you do at GMT Games, by the way.
Yeah, great. So I'm a staff developer at GMT Games. So I've been there since the fall of 2020. So I'm just over 3 years as an on-staff board game developer. Getting to work professionally in the industry has always been a dream of mine, and I've had an amazing time working on games with them. So it's been awesome.
Yeah. What does that involve? Like, what does being an official staff developer mean in the world of board games for people?
That's a really good question. I feel like probably people listening to this podcast understand at least a little bit better than a lot of people that ask me that same question all the time. What does that mean?
What are you doing?
So I like to tell people that it's most like has most in common with like a literary editor, right? So In the literary world, when somebody has a book, right, they pitch their book to a publishing company and somebody says yes or no. And if yes, then they get assigned an editor. And the editor kind of walks through them, polishing their book, polishing what they bring to the table, and then helping them go through the whole process from rough draft to final published product. And that's what I do at GMT. So when a new game comes to GMT as something that people are interested in having us take a look at, it might literally show up in my mailbox. And then I get to take a look at it, put the pieces together. More often than not, it looks like, you know, someone got out their kindergarten craft supplies and threw together a prototype. And then I take a look at it and kind of assess whether it's something that fits into our catalog, if it's something that, you know, is showing some promise. And then I will either kind of report back to that person on whether or not it's something that we would be interested in at all. And if we're interested, you know, where I think the design is at, and the work that needs to happen before we can kind of enter into more of a formal relationship. And then after that, I kind of walk it through the whole process. GMT has a unique way of kind of getting our games off the ground. We use the P500 system, which is like Kickstarter before Kickstarter. Yeah, like Kickstarter before Kickstarter was even a thing. I mean, GMT has been around since 1990, so they've been doing this for a very long time. And the great part about P500, it's kind of like voting without actually using any money, right? So we're looking for pre-orders on games, but nobody pays until the game actually ships. But that allows us to prioritize games in our pipeline and kind of decide, you know, what needs the most attention and when. And then, but from a designer's point of view, I work with them kind of getting their game ready to go on P500, making sure it's in a more than working state, right? Something that we feel like we're getting close to being able to publish, even though it needs to go through a development pass. Mm-hmm. And then I actually work with that designer really closely as they kind of together, we do play testing and we gather feedback and then we do some polishing passes on the game and on the rules. And then I work with them and our art department on helping that game become a product that people would love to have on their tables. And then after we go through all the proofing and all the rules writing and layout, then it gets shipped to the factory and then eventually comes back.
Yeah.
And then it goes to the game store.
It's such a process. I was very fortunate. I talked about this in the podcast a few weeks ago, but I was like very fortunate. I had so much fun being an official GMT game tester because I got to game test, play test, as you know, because I play tested it with you. 18 EUS, that's a new 18X game that's coming down the pike. And I had so much fun playing that. That was such a fascinating 18XX game, like really changed some of like the, some of the foundations, not massively, but like really like added some new, how would you say, not like wrinkles, but like changed some of like not even the structure, but some of the foundational elements that go into a lot of 18XX games by allowing players to take out personal loans instead of company loans, which if you're not an 18XX player, this literally means nothing to you. And I apologize, but for those of us who love the genre, it is like thrilling. So, but it was so fun. It was really fun to be part of that process. And how do you have, when you do game playtesting, like how do you synthesize all that information? Because we throw out surveys and stuff and things like that, and, you know.
Yeah, so this is kind of an internal process we use, but we use a lot of like Google feedback forms. Google forms allow us to kind of ask questions specifically about things that we have our eye on or we're looking for. And I usually tend to ask a lot of questions that don't seem to be very important, but I'm usually looking for something very specific to come to the surface. And then, of course, one of the things that was really cool about the 18 US playtest was that we got to use our own version or server of the 18xx.games website. And so it was really unique, right? Because we were testing on a kind of a digital platform, which we usually do through Tabletop Simulator, so it's not that different. However, all of those games got logged in our server, and then we had all of that data. So we are able to look through how all those games went, and so we were able to extrapolate a lot of just back-end data, which was something that as someone running playtesting, I've never had the opportunity to do before, because typically in a normal playtest, I'm reliant on making sure I ask enough questions in a form because I don't get like a copy of a transcript of someone's tabletop simulator play through, right? But on this, I literally have every play that was done for 18 US. We had all the information for. And so our developer, which that's in the formal coding sense, was able to go into that and like pull data points for us and let us really kind of dial in some of the things that we had. So from the play tester side, the forms were a lot more about experience and a lot more about perspective. Whereas when we needed the data, we got cold hard data, which was the first time I had that experience with play testing, because as I've already mentioned, we don't usually get to just kind of push a button and, you know, filter for the information we're looking for.
It would be great if more companies used platforms like that. I remember we talked about in the podcast how when Carnegie came out, it was a Kickstarter, but then after a Kickstarter, they released an implementation on BGA relatively quickly. And so they got a lot of data from BGA, and they could start to see which like departments in that game were maybe overpowered, and they were able to make really valuable tweaks. And I think that's such a good use of the platform, because like obviously as a user, it's like so fun to be able to go and, you know, play games, etc. But I think actually as a developer, there's like a lot of utility there.
So. Yeah, I think so too. It's definitely something we talk about and think through. One of the tricky things is often for us, especially GMT, our playtesting part comes before art, right? And so like if we put together a BGA, you know, kind of
prototype or
implementation
something.
Of the game prototype, it would be the ugliest BGA game. You know, when we put out playtesting materials for our Tabletop Simulator, they're not beautiful things. And you know, and part of the amazing, you know, piece of having such a huge playtest network, I mean, I probably have 200, 250, 300 people that I've kind of built into a playtesting network, and they're willing to like sit through that and like find the diamond in the rough, which is awesome. And so that was something that was so different about 18 US though, because any of us who enjoy playing 18XX games, it felt just like any other game that was on there already.
yeah, a generic art template that sort of gets pasted on all the games, especially when you go on that website, everything looks the same. So it was really useful. Right. And by the way, we should also mention you have an 18XX game that you designed that's coming out. That is actually playable by everyone, not just playtesters, on 18XX.games, which of course is 1822 PNW, which I've played actually several times now, and I've really, really enjoy for many reasons, but maybe chiefly because it takes place in the Pacific Northwest. And like that is like, it's just like really fun to build tracks to like Seattle and Portland and places like that. How's that process going along for you?
I mean, for me, it's been great. I think we just found out a week ago or 2 weeks ago that our games are on a boat. And so they're supposed to get delivered in January. So I'm very excited to hold it. It'll be the first time that I've held a design of mine in a finished product. And so, yeah, it's great. I actually had some a group. It's wild because you do all this work on a game and you play it 1,000 times and then you're like happy with it. Or maybe there's some things like for me, 22PNWs, I really like the way it turned out. But there's a couple things that a year after I submitted it to the publisher, I was like, yeah, you know, I might change this. I might change that if I did it again. But of course, just like anything, at some point you have to say, no, this is done and I'm going to do something different. But it was, I had a group on Discord actually who randomly reached out to me like 2 weeks ago and was like, hey, it would be awesome to play 22PNW with you. And I was like, okay, cool. Like I haven't played it in months. I mean, as you know, Ben, I had a baby 7 months ago.
Yeah, congratulations.
And so not a ton of 18XX. Thank you. Not a ton of 18XX recently.
We were actually supposed to hang out in Seattle, potentially to play games. Right. And, you know, your daughter just had to kind of crash the party that day.
She did. Which is funny. She heard that I made other plans and she's like, I got to show up.
I'm a little.
Yeah, that was a wild day.
It was a wild day. And I'm a little upset that you didn't name her Benita. You know, I thought like, you know, maybe there could be a tribute to me in there somewhere. But
shoot. Opportunity missed. But anyway, so I got to play 22PNW recently. And I was like, oh yeah, this is a fun game. It's just such a wild experience to be like, oh, cool.
Yeah.
And you're watching people enjoy your game and it's just such a satisfying feeling.
When you put it on 18XX.games, was that its final state or were you actually able to get some data from it sort of the way you were for 18EUS, like make a few little tweaks before you locked it in?
Yeah, we actually were able to make a couple of little tweaks towards the end. And mostly we made them as variants because we noticed that people preferred playing a couple of different ways. And one of the biggest things in that game specifically is the train rush, how fast the train roster goes through. And I had specifically built that game from a historical point of view. The argument that I'm making in 1822 PNW is that the local railroads built the railways of the West, and the giant railroads that come in towards the end of the game really just picked up the rail that was already here. Right. And so they started on the East Coast. They really built the Midwest. But when they got to the West, trains had been running and they ended up really just using track that was out here. And so in a lot of ways, they truly were, you know, acquiring these little companies and using their resources instead of, you know, being the things that they morphed into. And so I specifically kind of built the train roster so that was the local railroad space of the game was longer than some of the other 22 series where the majors play a bigger role. And therefore the majors are a longer portion of the time that you play in the game. Well, So there are some people who really prefer 22 as a system to kind of have that particular arc where the minors play a role, but a smaller role than the majors. And so by removing a couple trains, and it's literally two, by removing two early trains, you can actually switch that whole narrative. And so we add that variant in because of the preferences of some players. But the core rule stayed the same because that was the design intent to show that these locals played a really big role in building the West, and then the majors came in. So it's an interesting thing. We were able to grab a little of that data, but it did also come pretty late in the process. It wasn't nearly as helpful as obviously it was for 18US, which had some significant changes because of the playtesting that we got to do. But it was fascinating to get some of that data, and it was really cool that someone approached me. Like, I have no skills in coding at all, so it was great to have someone be like, hey, I'm really interested in your game. Can I put it on Dot Games? I was like, yes, please.
You're like, yeah, I mean, it's great. Actually, it's, I mean, it's interesting. It's so, I mean, this is one of the things I like about the 18XX system. And by the way, this is not an 18XX episode. We just happen to be talking about it because we nerd out about this stuff.
Yeah, Ben, but we were going to talk about other games.
There are other games. There's actually like Essen games that we will get to very shortly. But I do want to like, you know, my game brain is going right now. It's coming, guys, it's coming. But I was going to say, it is amazing how you remove two trains from your train roster in an 18XX game. And it gives a totally different experience. And also what's interesting about 18EUS is that what you guys did is you really built in this very dynamic system into the game that you don't really see in other 18XXs, wherein, you know, as a player, you can take out loans so you can invest more. Because for those who don't know about 18XX games, the general flow of the game is that you play as an investor. You invest money into train companies. And then if you are the biggest investor in a company, then you get to run the company, you get to build track, and then you get to run trains on those tracks. The trains get revenue. You get revenue kickback from that. And then you reinvest it again in further stock rounds. That's the general flow, and it builds and builds, and there's chaos, and there's twists and there's turns, and there's drama and heartache but joy and highs and lows and a full day's worth of entertainment, which is why I love it. But in 18EUS, what's so interesting is that there are no other 18XX games that I personally know of, but there may be, but I think it's the first time I've seen it where the player can take a loan. Usually companies can take loans, but here a player can take a loan to invest more. But then other players can invest in the bank that's giving the loans. And so the more loans that are going out, the more of an opportunity you're creating for people who are not taking on debt for them to actually capitalize off of you. But then the seesaw can go the other way, which is that if you start to capitalize, if you try to invest in the bank on spec, that people are going to start taking loans so that they can invest more. People may not take those loans because they don't want to help you out. So there's like a very dynamic push-pull in the game, which I imagine was actually really, really difficult to really fine-tune, which is why this implementation was like really helpful for the playtesting, right?
It was crazy helpful for that. I mean, that was one of the number one things that was a huge takeaway for us, was able to say like, well, this is how we think. I mean, so first of all, you know, 18US was designed by Greg Holton. So huge shout out to Greg.
Shout out to Greg.
A huge amount of work before it even got to my plate. And then, of course, once it comes in, you know, I sit down with Greg and I said, okay, Greg, you know, cool, very cool game. I think the weekend that he pitched me the game, it was in person at a Trax event a couple years ago. And
Trax is a convention and publisher.
Yes, in Denver, Colorado. Yep. For 18XX games. Happens twice a year. The guys out there are amazing. Super cool. Would recommend. They just had their fall con last weekend, actually. It ended today.
They competed with BravoCon? Is that what you're telling me? Because that's what happened. If they were last weekend, that's a tough choice for me. Luckily, I stayed home and went to no cons whatsoever.
Yeah, well, there's also a spring one, which is the one that I'm probably going to be at in May next year. But all that to say, I sat down, Greg pitched me the game, and I just went, oh, cool. And then I played it three more times that weekend, and it was like totally playable. And I was, you know, and so, but, you know, when we sit down in development, you know, it's often about a game that's like completely playable. And it's about like, okay, how to make this the best game it can be, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things was, you know, the really tricky thing about this seesaw between loans and player shares in the bank was not only to balance it in a particular game, but also across player counts, right? So yes. 18US plays 3, 4, and 5. And so we had to build three different models for the bank so that it worked in each of those player counts. And actually the hardest model was the three-player model, because just like in almost any three-player game that's ever been made, there's always this inherent issue where, you know, it can often become a 2v1 situation.
Yes.
And in this particular situation where two people take loans, one person going into the bank was having a significant advantage. And so how do you make that, you know, so it's still fun. So that's still like a game, right? And so then you have to figure out how you you know, balance across the interplay, and then it becomes more of like a, it becomes more of a, you know, standoff of,
yeah,
wait, are you gonna go bank? Don't go bank. Are you? Oh, he got it. Yeah. He got a loan. Okay. And then it's like, oh, she just paid off all of her loans. Is she gonna go bank? You know, and that was the tension really in the 3-player game,
yeah,
that had to be ironed out because it was pretty swingy, you know, earlier on, and now I think it's in a really good place. And the 3-player specifically, most of that data came from the playtest. And so, like, I don't know if we could have dialed that in as well as we ended up dialing it in if we didn't have all that data on the back end.
Yeah, that really was like a very fun part of it. I've been really into tempo games lately, or at least I should say I've been playing them. But I think I'm into them. Sure, I'm going to say I'm into them. I'm going to talk about some of them shortly. But before I do that, I just want to ask a few more questions about like GMT. I have a question about, it's actually not 18XX, because like GMT, I feel like, obviously, GMT is really known for certain really big titles like Twilight Struggle, which is like, that was number one on BGG for years and years. Thunder Alley, which I really enjoy, which is actually like a faux super NASCAR racing game. Dominant Species, you know, but I feel like you guys are really known for like your 18XX games, but also like mainly I feel like when I think of GMT, I really think of war games. And so, but I don't play war games only because I really have not been exposed to a lot of them. I played Maria, I played Friedrich, I feel like what are considered like the gateway war games. But like, is there like, how does one get into war games? Like, what is the path into war games? You know, like, is GMT,
that's such a good question.
And is GMT interested in converting new people to war games, or are you guys mainly interested to like service those who are already like in the war game niche?
The answer is yes, Ben.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I guess that's an obvious answer on that, you know, but you know.
No, it's a great question, though. I mean, it's an interesting question because it's actually one of the reasons why I was brought in. So GMT has been realizing that while their bread and butter for a long time has been historical simulation, conflict simulation, especially around war games, you know, there's this realization that if you help people become aware of who GMT is by maybe having games that maybe skew a little bit towards the more mainstream, then they also will be interested to see what else there is, you know? And so Thunder Alley is a great example of this, or Dominant Species is a great example of this, where, you know, are examples from the past of games that GMT had put out that haven't looked exactly like your typical hex encounter war game. And for those who don't know what a hex encounter war game is, it's effectively a war game where it's a big map of an area and it's all hexes. And those represent the spaces in which you can move your counters, which are little 1/2 inch to 3/4 inch squares that tell you the troops, or depending on the scale, like who's in that space. And then of course you put the, you know, you march your little stacks of counters across the board. And when they come into contact, they fight. Right. And that's kind of where, you know, so much of this history of war games come. And it's just a really super fun, very in-depth, tons of detail, tons of things going on that people, you know, really find fascinating. And, you know, that's a huge part of the audience that is GMT. But also, you know, GMT is asking questions about like, well, how do we continue to, you know, branch out and invite more people into the conflict simulation space? So that way they end up getting to those hex encounter games. Mm-hmm. They're awesome. They're huge. They're beautiful. They're amazing. They're so well designed, but they're like 18XX in the way that like, if you sit down to one the first time, you're going to be completely overwhelmed. So is that fun for you? Do you like swimming in the deep, you know, part of the pool right away? Do you like jumping in? Or are you a person who sits down and someone's like, okay, this is going to be a 6-hour game, and you're, you know, here's the historical background of what you're going to do. Good luck.
Yeah.
You know, some people love that, some people don't. And so the question is, well, you know, a lot of people can appreciate it once they get there. But the question is, how do we get them there? Right.
Right.
And so, so I've been kind of brought in as somebody who has a lot more of a mainstream background. I mean, when I came into the company 3 years ago, the number of war games I had played, you can count on both of your hands. And so, it was a huge learning curve for me, but also I got to bring in a perspective that was a lot more mainstream to help kind of guide the way that we present information, the way we do our rule books, the way that we think about building a catalog that brings people into a space instead of necessarily just keep putting out the stuff that the people who have been around a long time love. And we want to keep doing that. I mean, as a person who loves 18XX, which is a really great comparison between like these very heavy, very historically rich and nuanced Hex Encounter games, the similarities are there because, you know, it's the deep end, right? It's the far side of the niche. It's down the rabbit hole and around the corner, right? Yeah. And so getting people there takes time. And so it's like, how do we build that way? And so your question, rolling back to it, was how do you get into the war game space? That's a really good question. So it's one that we ask a lot, and we are typically trying to put out games that are really approachable, and they kind of hit different things for different people. And just like the way that I recommend people get into 18XX, I recommend that they get into war games, which is find somebody who loves it and play a game with them. I feel like getting into those games is tricky, right? And, you know, like one of the best things that I ever did for getting interested in historical war games was to watch Band of Brothers.
Oh, wow.
The 2000 and was it 2000?
2001 with Tom Hanks.
Yeah, I mean, it's an old like TV show from HBO, right? But you watch it and you're like, oh, I get it. Like I can all of a sudden I can understand what people are doing. You know, you're following the Airborne Division around and you're like, oh, I want to play a game where I'm the Airborne, you know? And I want to experience some of those like squad level interactions and experiences that they had. And then you can go play a game that's at that level, like Combat Commander is one of the games that is phenomenal in that space. And you can, you know, and a lot of people will say like, oh yeah, well, when you play Combat Commander, you feel like you're playing Band of Brothers. Well, if you haven't watched Band of Brothers, you're not going to have the same experience as somebody who has. But sitting across the table from somebody who like can explain to you like what's happening, why this is important, why this matters. Those are some really cool spaces to explore. I would say one of the number one games that's not out yet, but coming, if you're interested in, if you like Euro games and you're interested in something that's going to skew or going to help you go like get into war games,
go to the
right
war,
now,
war on, space.
Go to the war space is a game called Firefight Tactical. So Firefight Tactical is this new game on P500 from GMT Games. It should be coming out probably mid to late 2024. And it's really awesome because it's a squad level. So like that level we're talking about where you actually like there's, you know, small groups of people and you're kind of you're in it. You feel like you're in it. Uh-huh. But it's a dice drafting game. And so, you know, it's set in World War II, but at the beginning of each turn, you roll a set of dice, and then each of your unit cards has a list of actions that you can take, but you have to be able to use one of the dice that was rolled to do it. And so it kind of melds this very cool dice drafting Euro feel with this very, I would say, like traditional kind of squad level tactical war game. And so it's going to be one of those games for us that I think is going to be a really excellent entry point into
that
space.
Can I say the name of it again? I'm like writing it down.
Yeah, it's Firefight Tactical.
Oh, Firefight Tactical.
Firefight Tactical.
I'm like writing it down. Very cool. Also, so I can remember for show notes, but I'm like, oh, that sounds actually pretty good. Okay.
Yeah, it's going to be really cool. And I have to also shout out Sam London, the designer for that game.
Shout out to Sam London.
Sam London is one of our new designers, and he pitched us Firefight Tactical almost a year ago, but he just pitched us a couple of new games at our last weekend at the warehouse, which was in October. And I'm telling you what, he has a game that we're going to be putting out that is mind-bogglingly good. It's
really?
Like, I can't even wait to announce it. I can't right now, but I'll tell you this, when it comes out, people are going to lose their mind and they're not going to believe that it was a GMT game. It's just so cool.
Now, and this, by the way, I want to say this is not an advertisement for GMT. I'm just merely picking Ken's.
No, I just happen to work there, so we have to talk about it. You can't help it.
Your excitement is genuine. I know your excitement is genuine.
That's true.
Like, you're not like a used car salesman who's here to do like a whole, you know, thing, but I'm excited. When do you think you're going to be announcing that one?
That's a really good question. I'm pretty sure that we have plans to announce it early next year. So Q1, Q2.
We'll keep an ear out for that. Okay. So in the meantime, let's talk about some of the games we've been playing.
Yeah.
You told me that you have recently been playing Sky Team, which I'm excited about because I just got my copy and I have not been able to play it yet. And I just stare at it and I stare at it. I'm like, how can I not find a single person to play this 2-player game with me? So please tell me everything so I can have Sky Team FOMO, please.
Sky Team's incredible. It's one of those designs that you play and you're like, oh, this was so smart. Like, as a person who's a developer and a designer, I often will play games and be like, oh, wow, why didn't I think of this? Sky Team is one of those games. So my wife and I, as I mentioned, we had a baby 7 months ago. And so the brain space that we've had together to play games have been mostly co-op. So the majority of the stuff that we've been playing is cooperative. And Sky Team is perfect for us right now because it's 20 minutes. Like, a long game of Sky Team is like 21 minutes.
Wow.
And so the premise of Sky Team, for those who haven't heard, Sky Team is it's 2-player only co-op where the goal of the game is to land a plane. So you're a commercial airline pilot, co-pilot, and you are effectively throughout the course of the game, every turn, you're getting closer in elevation to coming down and landing at an airport. So wheels on ground. At the same time, you're trying to get closer in distance. So the elevation is decreasing every round, whether you like it or not. So you better figure it out, because if you get to the end of the 7 turns and you haven't figured it out, you crash the airplane into the ground, right?
Right.
So, but part of figuring it out is decreasing the distance from the airport that you are. And so you kind of have to line it up in round 7 to both get the wheels on the ground at the airport at the right time.
So there's a bunch of different things. And not before the airport.
Exactly. So there's a little bit of like a timing thing that you're working together. And so it's one of those co-ops where it's a like a no communication co-op, right? So it's a dice placement game. So you roll dice, they have numbers on them, and then there's all these like almost work replacement spots on this shared board. And you can place your dice there, but they have to have the right number. Or some of the spaces have a wild, or some of the spaces have like 2 numbers and it could be one or the other. And so you roll your dice into this very kind of fun little shield, like a player shield, but it looks like a cockpit. So you roll your dice into your cockpit, and then you have, and it's 4 dice. And so you have to play your 4 dice. And so every turn you have to play your dice in, you have 2 spaces that you're required to play your dice. And then you have 2 more dice that end up being placed kind of wherever they're needed. And so the pilot has 2 jobs that are unique from the 1 job of the co-pilot. And the 2 jobs that are unique to the pilot is that they have to get the landing gear down and they have to get the brakes ready for landing. And the co-pilot's job, unique job, is to make sure that the flaps are up all the way for landing. And so what's cool, though, is as you put the landing gear down and as you put the flaps up, you create resistance and drag. And so it gets harder to move the plane towards the airport.
Oh, so good.
You're actually slowing the plane down. It's very good. So the 2 required spaces that you have to play on is you have to play 1 die to the stability track, and you have to play 1 die to effectively the distance or speed of the plane track. And so it's your die plus your partner's die equals, when you put those numbers together, it gives you a rating between 2 and 12, because we're D6s. I didn't say that, but we're playing with D6 placement. And so that tells you how much further you progress towards the airport in distance. And then the other 2 that you place for stability is interesting, because the goal is when you land, you need the plane to be flat. you know? Yeah. Horizontal, I mean, what do they call that? The yaw of the plane? Isn't that what they call
it? Yeah, the yaw. We're on Zoom and I'm like actually emulating the plane
we're
twisting.
Both dancing,
and I'm like,
going back and forth.
I'm acting like anyone listening to the podcast can see this, but I'm doing like this little demonstration, like a little dance.
Yeah.
Like I've seen the pictures of they have the player board, they have like an actual airplane in the center with its wings and there's like a line. And you want those wings to be along that horizontal line, it's not the plane, but it's the land, right? It's like the horizon isn't it the horizon that is
exactly. It's that yaw, that back and forth, the flat or the balance of the plane. But anyway, so when you land, you need to be perfectly flat. However, as you place those dice, you take the larger die, you subtract the smaller die, and then you clock it that many times towards the person who was higher. So if I played a 5 and you played a 4, then we would clock it once in my direction and then we'd be off center. But if we both play 4s, then it stays at wherever it was. And so by the end of the 7 rounds, when you're landing, you need to be flat. So those are kind of all different things that you're trying to balance as you play this really quick 20-minute game where you're trying to land a plane at the airport. And then what's cool is as you play the game, there's little scenarios, and then they introduce more sideboards that give you more things to place and worry about with your dice. And then also, one thing that I didn't mention is one of the standard spots is that there's planes that have to land before you. And so if you are trying to decrease your distance to the airport, but that you haven't removed the plane that's in front of you, then you run into it and you lose. Yeah. And so you have to use your calm spot. Yeah, you have to call air traffic control. Hey, I need you to land this plane. And then it's effectively you're able to pull it off the track and then you move forward. But what's crazy is as they get more complicated, sometimes you have to fly around a mountain on your way towards landing the plane. And so you actually have to plan to turn the stability so that the yaw of the plane is such that you kind of skirt the mountain and stuff. It's very cool. It's very fun. Plays really quick. And it's just a brilliant little game. So highly recommend Sky Team.
I was drawn to this immediately because I love real world theme, I can play fantasy, whatever, but I love things that are drawn from the real world. And this just seems like what's great about this is that it's like a cooperative game that like thematically makes all the sense. You know, it has automatic inherent high stakes. Like you do not want to crash the plane. It reminds me of being a kid in the 80s playing the Top Gun video game and you have to land on that aircraft carrier, which I never really was able to do in that game, but it's like that was what you do. And any game that has that inherent high stakes where you feel it, like you just understand like what could go wrong. I mean, so I think it's one of the reasons why Pandemic is so good, because the dread of a virus spreading, or I love Pandemic Rising Tide. I feel like people don't talk enough about that pandemic, but it's actually my favorite pandemic. But like this floodwaters sort of, building up and going to take over and you feel that dread. There are other games that are...
And then like the dike breaks and you're like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden just like explodes all over the board. And like one second you were doing well, everything was fine. And then another second it's like literally like the game ends, which is frustrating for people. But I personally think that cooperative games should be hard. I think that's like the point. Like when people are like, I always lose at it. I don't like this game. It's like, that you're it's supposed to be rare and special when you win. And is Sky Team like that? Have you found? Is it hard to do, or is it start off sort of like easy to do and gets harder as you go along?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where the better you know your partner, the better you're gonna do.
Yeah.
So because there's definitely ways to communicate without communicating, right? Mm. And so like my wife and I have we've been playing games the whole time we've been married, so. We've been married for, since we're dating, 12 years of playing games together. And so, I think the first mission or the first, landing, we were like, okay, yeah, like that was pretty straightforward. But then you start adding some of those sideboards and things get more complicated. And I think there was one like maybe the third or fourth scenario, we ended up, I think we had to play it five times before we ended up being able to land the plane. And we were just like, you've got to be. I mean, and my wife is very competitive, and I swear she was not happy. And
no, I wouldn't be happy either.
I played a die where I shouldn't have. And man, I almost watched her like flip the table. She's like, are you kidding me? You played a die there? Oh, sorry, babe.
But you know, so, I think
it can get heated.
That's good. I like that. And I think that one of the things that is appealing to me is that it also just sounds to me like a cooperative game where it just sounds actually like fun to do. And when I say fun to do, like, of course, a game should be fun to do. But it actually seems like fun to step into the shoes of pilot and co-pilot. And so even if it was something that we could do relatively easily, it feels like kind of like a fun simulation that you're doing. And it also seems like something that everyone would understand. Like, I could imagine pitching a game like this to someone who's maybe not totally, like, maybe not really a gamer. Like, my boyfriend is not a gamer. I wonder if I could play it with him, because if I said, like you're pilot, I'm pilot, you're a co-pilot, we have to land a plane. Like, it's that, I mean, when you talk about in, you know, with like movies, when people pitch movies or TV shows, you know, the dream is the high concept pitch where you can just say it in a line and everyone gets the vision and you know it and you want to go forward with it. And this is like, to me, this is such a high concept game. It's like what I just said, I'm pilot, you're co-pilot. We have to land a plane. If we don't, we die, you know?
Yeah. Well, and there's something too about the fact that, like, even if you're not like a huge aviation person, like,
which
everybody's
I'm not.
Been on a plane and been like, man, I wonder what's going on up there.
Yeah.
You know, like everyone's ridden in a plane and been like, oh man, you know, and it gives you like this huge appreciation for all the things. And of course, this is just a stripped down simulation of things that pilots actually have to like think through. But you're like, oh yeah, I didn't really think about the fact that there might be drag or resistance. Mm-hmm. And the timing's really important. And obviously, you know that, like, planes don't crash into each other very often, hardly ever, thank God. But, you know, it's just this thing where it's like, oh yeah, you're right in the fact that it's like the simulation that you can easily place yourself in. And you're like, I don't even know what that actually takes, but I want to try it.
Yeah.
And so I think it's one of those games where I've been thinking like, oh, who do I know that's maybe not super into games who I think would enjoy this experience? Also, one of the greatest parts about that is it's co-op. And one of my favorite things about co-op is I think that it's one of the best introductory spaces because people, especially with people who are really competitive, because people don't like to lose to people who play a lot of games, you know? Mm. And so it's like, you know, when you're playing games for the first time with somebody who hasn't, you're like, okay, do I go easy on them? Do I take us, you know, the amount of times that I've won viticulture by just doing the tasting room strategy, because I'm like, okay, this is game clock. Like, if you can't figure out how to make and produce wine in the time I can win by a tasting room,
that's funny.
You know, strategy,
tasting then, room game then clock.
That was it.
Only in the world of board gaming can there be a concept where, okay, I'm going to play a game where I'm going to build a tasting room where I'm going to sit and drink wine for the entire game. And at a certain point, I'll have had so much wine. I will have tasted so much wine that I've just won.
I'll have won. So, yeah. So anyway, and so co-op is great for that, right? Because you invite them into an activity to do together.
Yes.
And then you throw a theme on it like this, which, you know, people are like all over the place on zombies or whatever else. Mm-hmm. But with a plane, come on. Who doesn't want to try and land an airplane?
I can't imagine that there might be some people who are actually like triggered by the this theme. This could hit like there. You know, I can imagine like the idea of flying a shaky plane, and if you fail, the plane crashes and you die, could hit like it could hit some people's major anxieties, and for an unlucky few, it could actually touch on some trauma. But like, given that, like, really, probably many games could do that. I mean, honestly, pandemic, talk about that. But you know, so I can't imagine that for some, this might actually be a harrowing game. It seems like I haven't played it. I shouldn't even be talking on behalf of it, but I have to say that by and large, it does seem like actually a very inviting and accessible theme. And that's like, it also speaks to how important a theme is in a game, because look how a theme has drawn us into this game. And like, and I haven't even played it. I'm like, I'm sitting here talking, I'm just staring at it.
Play
but
it.
I'm just, but like,
man, I, you gotta I play it. Wait. It's fun.
I'm so going to play it.
Also, it's on BGA. So if you can't find someone to play it, let's just get on BGA and play it together.
Okay, let's do it. Because I, for like all of September, okay, live play right now. I was texting people. I was like, who wants to play it? And I couldn't get anyone to play it with me. So maybe that's what people think about me as a potential pilot. So I don't know. I play.
Ben, tell me, what have you been playing?
What have I, you know, thank you so much for asking.
You're welcome.
I have actually, okay, where should I start? The game that I'm like very excited about these days, that I'm sure we're going to do like a deep dive into, but, one that I've now played twice is Evacuation by Vladimir Suchy. Have you heard about this game? Do you know anything about it?
No, I'm looking it up on Board Game Geek right now.
So it is,
and I can't spell it, so I missed it.
Evacuation. There have been a lot of jokes about the word evacuation, etc., which of course I will be happy to indulge in anytime anyone wants. I will always make a poop joke. But basically the gist of the game is that we are on a planet. Maybe it's Earth, maybe it's not Earth, but we're on a planet that was once thriving. But the nearby sun is growing too big and destroying. It's going to slowly destroy us all. And we have to leave this planet and we have to evacuate, if you will, and go to a new planet to take over. And the gist of the game is basically that we start with just a beautiful planet, which AKA in game terms is a beautiful, humming, brimming, exciting engine. In the sense that we get all the resources, like all our resources, we have a fully built engine. We have everything we could possibly need and want and dream of.
Interesting. Okay, sure.
And then because we have to move, we have to dismantle that engine and move it over to a new world. And so what you have is this game experience where your engine that was once wonderful is now falling apart and you are going from riches to rags, but by the end of the game, you've then built your engine back up again in the new place. So now you're riches again. So it's riches to rags to riches. And it's this really
interesting.
Yeah. It's this really cool arc of a game. And it takes place over four rounds. There's a lot to it. This is obviously, I'm just giving a very surfacey version of it.
Sure.
But I'm finding this game to be really interesting. And I'm really excited to dive more deeply into it because the first play, I was like, that was good. That was like, I was in a space of admiring it more than maybe I enjoyed it. I was like, that was good, but didn't give me that like feeling inside. We're like, oh my God, oh my God. Like the first time I played Underwater Cities, sure. which is Vladimir Suchy's like really big hit from the past, you know, 7 or 8 years. I was like, every single action, I was feeling it. I call it the tingles. I was feeling the tingles. I was like, oh my God, this is so good. Have you played Underwater Cities?
That's the one with the little like domes, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know if you, I don't know where you stand on it or anything, but I just really love the combo of the tableau building and sort of like worker placement and all that stuff. And I just found deeply exciting. Like every time I play it, I always have so much fun.
There's just something about the way it all works together that just really excites you.
Yeah. So with this one, at first I was like, okay, like this was interesting and it was good and it was fun. It didn't give me that tingle, those tingles. But I think that part of the reason why is because the game has, you play it in two modes. You choose one of two modes, and then there's several modules you can attach. And one mode, the recommended starter mode is like a race mode where you're not even playing for points. You're racing to be the first to get your production in the new world to a certain benchmark and also to build three stadiums, which I think is funny because the stadiums are like the abstracted version of happiness. Like, oh my God, we have three stadiums on this planet. We're like so happy we have sports, you know? So
cool. Sure.
Yeah. Like why not? So like in race mode,
as you do,
like, it's like, I feel like the first thing that I'm like, if we move to a different planet, I feel like a big priority would be to build Madison Square Garden. You know, I feel like that's maybe that.
Yeah. Okay.
Maybe, I don't know. Like, I'm trying to think of a stadium that's up there in Seattle to make it more, more appealing to you.
I don't know if any stadium, I mean, I love my sports ball team. So I've got the Sounders up here. We've got the Mariners.
Yeah.
But, I don't, you know, it's crazy to me to think that like the thing you're trying to, we will have arrived when we have st- stadiums.
Yeah, stadiums. It's like, we're doing so well. We have so much excess money that we're just going to build a stadium. Like,
yeah, we have sports sort of, again.
Yeah. And conventions. But
yeah, that's right.
So like in race mode, the moment that someone reaches this benchmark, the game just ends. And so what's happened is that it sort of, there's, like I said, there's four rounds, and a lot of times the game ends just like in the middle of the fourth round, which feels sort of weird and anticlimactic. And there's this feeling like we spend all this effort to like rebuild our engine, and then all of a sudden, like you've rebuilt it and now you're ready to like use that engine that the game seems to be all about, right. But then it ends before you can really use it because someone just hit a mark. And like, it's still actually very fun, but I wonder if that's where I didn't get that full like tingle. However, the second time I played it, it was like the game came to life for me. I think that there's something about sometimes like you need to lay the foundation for a game. And then like once you're like aware of the things that can go wrong and the things you need to flog or the things you need to do or appreciate more, suddenly the game becomes like so much more exciting, you know, because you understand the stakes a little bit more. Given that you know that, you know, okay, I got to get my engine ready and yada, yada, yada. But like in Underwater Cities, you understand the stakes, which is I need that spot. And you just took that spot. Like, you know, I understand worker placement. You understand your stakes because it's like your stake is like if you don't do that, if someone else takes that spot, you can't do the thing you want to do. Mm-hmm. But in this one, it's more like, oh, now I realize I need to really do this sort of action. And maybe I do it here or there. And what is exciting me about evacuation is that it's really all about tempo. When are you gonna shut down different parts of your engine, and when are you gonna turn them back on the new world? And it's fascinating. Like, I think the design is so fascinating.
Is it shared? Is it like, is it, or do you have a sector that's your engine? How does that work?
On the old world, you have your own section, and everyone's section is the same.
So it's like, this is my pie. This is my piece of pie.
It is literally like that. Everyone has like a slice of the pie. Everyone has the same engine. Okay. But in the new world, there are, it's like all up for grabs. And when you sort of like rebuild your stuff in the new world, you're basically taking over hexes on the board. Basically that's the board game ease of it. It's just that like you're taking over hexes. And different hexes will do different things for your new engine. You know, like you might want this spot because it's going to give me three boosts to food production. But maybe I might want a different spot because it satisfies a card that I have that like once I have like a factory here and then I have some people in the same horizontal line, then that card says, congratulations, now you get three production of this. So...
You're constantly
evaluating a lot of factors and where you want to place it, but the other people are too, and they get in your way. Admittedly, it's not a high interaction game necessarily, but I haven't played all the modules that do it more. But
I mean, with two plays, you have to be careful. But
yeah, I'm not making any blanket statements. But what I have to say is that I am like really fascinated by this design, and I think what makes me excited about it is that Vladimir Suchy's, is it Suchy or Suhi? I don't remember. I'm never quite sure if I'm saying it correctly. So apologies to Vladimir if he's listening. To Vlad.
I think it's Suchy.
Suchy. Okay. I'm going to go with Suchy. I'm ignorant. What can I say? His recent games have been all really fun, but they've been kind of like meditations on really interesting Euro-y things. Like, here's an action selection wheel, and as it turns, you get different bonuses when you do this, and you do this, and you get a combo. It's like very Euro-y. And this one, I feel like what I like about it is that it seems to be concerned with not like, hey, here's some gimmicky ways to play a game. And I don't mean gimmicky in a dismissive way. I mean, like, here's like cool mechanisms. Right. How are you going to use them? How are you going to use them and see what points you can get? This one's like, here's some really basic actions you can do, but like, how are you going to approach how you play this game? And like, that is going to affect your outcome in it. So I just feel like there's like a deep level of, yeah, it's about how you approach the game, not about like, how can you figure out the puzzle of these of mechanisms or mechanics or whatever, you know? So I'm really keeping my eye on it, and I'm like really, really excited to dive deeper and sort of to play around in it. It's going to be, I don't know if it's going to be something up your alley or not. It seems like some people have really responded well to it. There's some people who absolutely love it. There's some who are a little more cold on it. So I can't tell.
Yeah.
But yeah. Hmm. Well, you know, next time you're in town.
Yeah, it's hard to say. Yeah. Oh man, I wish. It was only about a year ago that we played Roads and Boats together.
I know, that was so fun.
Is that crazy? Yeah, it sounds like something I'd love to play. I mean, one of the things that's tricky is there's so many games that come out right now, and it's like, man, can you, you know, I would love to try it. I mean, one of my favorite Vladimir Sushi games is Prodigal's Club. I thought that was such a brilliant design from a theme perspective. Like, yeah, theme's how great, fun that. Is it to be like, okay, who can squander this the best, you know? Right. It's just like such a interesting reverse, you know, game. And so yeah, I would love to play it if I had the opportunity.
So what else have you been playing?
Let's see, going to my BG stats here.
Go in.
One of my most played games since in the last couple of months is a game called 535, which is a card game from the Portland Game Collective. So the Portland Game Collective is this group of people in Portland who just love everything card games. And yeah, they kind of have taken it upon themselves to try and get games that are maybe out of print or never had a real print run or have only been printed overseas. Yeah, exactly. Printed overseas. And so they've been like bringing over a ton of cool games. One of them, their second game that they put out, is 535, and it's just this brilliant little shedder game. So the goal, like, of any shedder is you get dealt your hand of cards, and the goal of the game is to be the first to go out. And then in 535, when you go out, you get to, then everybody else has to count the little points in their hand that they still have. And of course, like, when somebody busts by getting, I want to say it's 18 points, if I remember off the top of my head, then the person with the lowest points wins the game, right? Okay. So usually it's between like 3 and 5 hands. And so it's pretty quick. However, one of the cool things is the reasons why it's called 535 is because there's the first 5 cards are 1 through 5, mm-hmm, and then it skips 6. So there's no 6 in the deck.
Okay.
And then it goes 7, 8, 9. So okay. 3.
All right.
And then it skips 10, and then it goes 11 through 15. So it's 535 of the like different kinds of cards in play.
Okay.
And the cool thing about it is the way in which you can play cards out. So if you play a single card, then you can obviously play a higher single card to beat the lower single card. You mm-hmm. cannot play the same, you have to play higher. If you play a pair of cards, or then you can play a higher pair. Or if you play it like 3 of a kind, you can play higher 3. But the thing is, on your turn, you may only lay down 3 cards.
Okay.
And so the last kind of thing you can do is a set, right? Or a run, if you will. So, you know, you can play 1, 2, 3 or 3, 4, 5, but of course there's no 6 and there's no 10. So when you're thinking about those runs, kind of goes with the thing, but here's the thing. Here's the catch. There's a couple of catches.
There's always a catch.
One of the catches is that the runs, everything else, the singles, doubles, triples, they all build. So if I play a 1, you can play a 2. But on a run, if you play 7, 8, 9, then I have to play a lower run. So I have to play like 3, 4, 5.
Oh.
Okay. So it's kind of it goes down instead of up. So it's interesting. And then another thing that's very cool about the game is you can add to it. So let's say you play 2, 3, 4. On my turn, I can play the 1 and the 5.
Oh,
and then
funky.
It finishes the round because there's no 6, so nobody can add to it.
So if you can't add to it, then if you can't yes and so the then, combination, then the round is over.
Exactly. And well, and so and then that person gets to play out first, right? And so what's the most interesting thing about 535 is when you read it teaches you to think differently about how you read what you've been dealt. Because if you played a lot of card games, you have kind of an idea. Even if I tell you you can play singles, doubles, triples, or run, you have an idea of how you might go about that. And you can look at your hand and you can think, okay, I think that's how I'm going to play this hand. However, because of the additions of being able to add to other people's things, and then having these weird breaks in them, you can look at your hand and be like, in most card games, this would be an crazy good hand. And in this game, I have no idea how I'm going to do. And so it reteaches you. And so after, I think I've played about 30 times. And after about 30 plays, I'm like, I've retrained my brain on what it means to like look at a hand of cards. But it's just taken so much. The first like 10 games, I just sat there like, oh, that did not go how I thought it was going to go. So a very cool game. If you're into trick takers, if you're into card games, Shedders, 535, check it out. The people at Portland Gaming Collective are amazing. They're doing some really cool stuff. And this is kind of a game you can pick up on their website. So check it out, 535.
That sounds amazing. Yeah, there's been like over the summer in the Game Brain group, there was like a real trick taker moment. Like Matt Robinson was really, he was really, really enthusiastic. And but like so were others. It wasn't just him, but like I feel like he's a very enthusiastic guy. And so when he gets really excited about something, it sort of is like infectious amongst all of us. So he's probably played this, or he probably already owns it, because I think he's talked about this collective. But yeah, but it's cool. I've definitely, during that chapter, the ones that I really, the trick takers, I played several of them. I was never quite as into the trick takers as everyone else, but I really enjoyed them. Yeah. And Schadenfreude and Robotrick.
It's my
and
favorite.
Robotrick or Schadenfreude?
Well, Schadenfreude is my absolute favorite all-time trick-taking game, but I do really like Robotrick. That's really cool. That's really new. That's like a super fresh take, so it probably came up this summer.
Yeah, Schadenfreude, I've actually only played it once, and I love it. We've actually talked about a bunch of the podcast, so I'm not going to go into it, but that's another one which I really love, how it makes you rethink like how you play your cards. Robotrick is so fun. I heard about, somewhere along the way, I heard about a Japanese game called Gadget Trick. I think I subscribed. There's like one or two people on BGG. I apologize. I don't remember your names, but they have like these geek lists. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to do some research about trick takers. Like, here's someone who like constantly is posting on a geek list about trick takers. And they gave like a really good review to this game called Gadget Trick. And you can't find it anywhere. It was like this, I was like, I don't even know what this game is about. It has almost no documentation on BGG. And then I went to the website Tricky Imports, and somewhere along the way, I guess I clicked something like alert me if it ever comes into stock, and it came to stock. So I just bought it. I was like, I'm going to buy it. I'm going to do this. Like, maybe I'm going to find a gem. And it actually arrived when I was in New York last month. And so I haven't been able to play it yet, but this is like, it's all Japanese. I have to print out stuff. I have to actually find sleeves so I can like insert English text into the sleeve so you can actually play the game.
I love it.
But like, I'm really excited because I feel like everyone's always introducing me to like obscure trick taking games. And I'm like, please be good.
It's my turn.
This is going to be my turn. I'm going to be a trick taker, tastemaker someday. But the guys that... It's like, you just have to have goals. You know, sometimes you have to have goals in life. But the guys on Happy Cardboard,
everyone needs that
it.
Person.
Yeah. Well, you know.
Everyone needs that person. I have a friend, who's really gotten me into trick takers. And it's funny because he'll like show up to game day, or I'll show up to his house, and he like puts all of these like Japanese trick takers on the table. And then he's like, which one do you want to play? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, this one. He's like, okay. So then he's like, he has to like go through his binder to find the English rules. You know, he's like, and I just like appreciate him so much because he's introduced me to so many of the most amazing games. But like, I couldn't play them without like somebody who's willing to do the work of, you know, going deep into this thing, you know. And so
you do have to.
Such a wild world.
And of course,
the trick taking Japanese world is like another very deep niche like rabbit hole, which is so rewarding. And the way that the games that are coming out of Japan like make your brain think are so incredible. They're amazing game designers, And just makes me, I'm just like so excited every time I see a card game that has like Japanese on the cover. I'm like, okay, this is going to be an exciting and new experience. It's super cool.
I'm really excited to get Gadget Trick to the table. Although it's like very classic me that like months after the trick taking thing happens in our group, it's like it's come and gone. And I'm like, guys, wait a second. One last one. I found one. So I feel like people be like, Ben, this is fine. But like, you know, we're over it. Actually, Everyone's gonna be like, this is 3 months ago. Essen games are in now. Actually, I feel like I played a really interesting one. What did I play? Oh, Nikosu Dice. Oh, I'm not going to Nikosu Dice because
that's a cool game.
Yeah, but it was talked about at length on this podcast, but I finally got to play it. Yeah, and it was really cool and really interesting. And you know, another one I really like is a game called it's not cards, it's a dice trick taking game, but Matt introduced it to me, to some of us, Mino Dice, which kind of takes the Skull King thing. And if you actually look up Mino Dice, M-I-N-O Dice, it actually says on BGG that it re-implements Skull King, which is kind of funny. The theme is like you're minotaurs, or there's like dice that are minotaurs and some are mermaids. It doesn't make any sense, but the game is outrageously fun. But another game that I played just hours ago, Ken, hours ago, with our dear, wonderful friend Candace, and others, played Kutna Hora, which is a new game that came out in Essen. I knew nothing about it. I think I'd vaguely heard about it. It's by CGE. I mean, it's released by CGE. So the designer, oh God.
Will you spell that for me, Ben? Can you spell that for me?
Yeah, I would love to. K-U-T...
What if I want to look it up?
You know what? Here's what you do. K-U-T-N-A, Kutna, Hora, H-O-R-A, colon...
Got
the
it.
City of
the
Silver.
City of Silver.
Yeah.
Found it.
Okay. The designers. Okay. This is going to be real fun. These are all, I believe, Czech designers, and there's like all sorts of accents. So let's go for Andfej Briston, Petra Kaslava, and Pavel Jarosh. I'm sorry to all three of you for probably how
it was.
It was
a valiant effort. Valiant effort.
Thank you. This game is like, to me, it felt like a middleweight game actually, but like maybe it's actually heavier than that. When Candace was teaching it, I was like, whoa, there's a lot going on here. I got first excited about this game because one of our co-hosts, Jordan, had mentioned on Discord that he played it and he really liked it. And, he said that he really liked the market in this game. We probably are going to go deeper in this game on the podcast, so I'm not going to go too into this. But basically, we as a group are we're building like a town or city. This is a real life place that apparently at one point was like the silver destination in Czechia. And the game is basically you have cards, and every card has two actions on it. And on your turn, you play two cards. You basically get to play five actions in a round. The first turn you play two actions, second turn you play two actions, third turn you play one action. And so a lot of the game is making trade-offs between like, oh, I want to build a building, but if I use this card, I'm giving up my opportunity to, you know, like get income, because that's the other action on the card. Like, you have to make trade-offs on how you use these cards. So the card play is really, really fun. And there are some really interesting market dynamics in the game. Like, one thing that's really fun is that there are no resources. So there's like, it seems like there's a lot of resources because there's pork, there's beer, there's wood, there's silver, there's ore. So that is like, oh, that seems like there's resources. But what it is there's actually just like transaction rates. So like wood might be at four. So you never, if you want to use wood, you never actually have little wooden tokens. What you do is, if wood is at four, for every wood that you want to use, you spend $4. So it's all different transaction rates, which is interesting, A, because that's a really clever way to get around having to have components. But B, it's like really, it's also true. Cool because like, as you build more buildings, more wood-oriented buildings, because every resource has different buildings attached to it. So if you build more wood-oriented buildings, or maybe if you build more beer buildings like taverns, etc., their values actually decrease because you're creating supply. Huh. right? So if you build too many,
sure.
if you build too many beer buildings too quickly, then like that goes down and that's tied to, there's a production. So if you produce beer, you're going to get more, you won't get as much money for your beer production if the value of beer has gone down because you built too many beer buildings, you know. But as you are right. building out this city, your population starts to come in, and as population comes in, the values of these resources actually go up because now the supply is being used. It's really cool, and it's very Euro-y, but it has some economic elements, and I just, it felt very, very clean to me. Like it felt, it was like, it, I was like, this is a really, really good game. Like it was, it just like worked. It's, I'm going to have to buy a copy of this. You've That's never awesome. Heard of it? Have you, I feel like I had never heard of it. Has I mean, this ever been on your radar before?
I, you know, I just saw Candace a couple weeks ago at the weekend at the warehouse. And I think she mentioned this to me. I think she said,
she's loving
I think I
game.
Said, what stood out to you? And she's like, Kutnohora. And I was like, okay. Like, you know, it went in, went out, but that's cool to hear that you guys are getting it to the table and enjoying it.
Yeah. No, she says of like, she told me today, and I'm hoping I'm not misquoting her, but that of like the new Essen crappy games that she's had, this one seems to be her favorite. It just was, it's, you know, it's like that thrill you get when a game just works and it works cleanly.
Yeah.
Recently, cool. You know, I haven't been a huge Voidfall fan. Like we did a sort of Voidfall preview a few weeks ago. And I thought like some of it was really good. And I was actually pretty enthusiastic, like not pretty enthusiastic, but I was like, I enjoyed it in that preview, but then in the follow-up play, like my opinion of Voidfall really kind of like went downhill. And a thing with Voidfall is that one of the central elements of it is that you have card play, and there's three, you can only play a certain amount of cards per round, and every card has three actions on it, but you can only play two actions unless you pay to do the third one. So it's the same thing where you're choosing which card you're going to play, and you're making tough decisions on which actions you're sacrificing. It's funny because to me, it's not fair to compare games, but like for all of the stuff that goes into Voidfall, this big ass game, I felt like I was getting the same joy of like making decisions between these cards with a much cleaner design in Kutnohora. And I know people are really loving Voidfall, but this to me is an example of like, here you can have that same rich decision space of like deciding on your card, like how you want to sequence your actions and which ones you're going to do, but with like a more, to me, what felt like a more elegant game. So I really, I really recommend it. And I think that people should definitely seek it out or try it, you know? So
yeah. Awesome.
What about you? You mentioned a game that you've been playing recently that you said is about to, that you've been really into, that I think is about to get out to the public.
Yeah, that's true. So I have just a whole list of cooperative games that I've been playing because as we talked about. But there's technically two that I can think of that are meet that criteria. One that I was talking to you about earlier is one that GMT put out and that I developed, which, so I'm biased, like straight up,
of course,
very biased. But the game that I'm talking about is The Plum Island Horror by Herman Luttman. And this is a game that feels very much outside the normal GMT wheelhouse. But I got to say, it is just a blast to play. It's a cooperative game for 1 to 4 players where you are playing as a faction of people that live on Plum Island. And there's a natural disaster on Plum Island. And of course, the research facility on the island has a critical failure. And all of the scientists that are working at this facility are infected by this
Professor Plum, if you will.
Ooh, that's good. I'm gonna write that down for the expansion. That's a deep cut.
Yeah, that's a board game joke.
That's a deep cut.
A board game joke.
I love it.
Joke on a board game podcast. You're welcome, everyone. Anyway, go on. So the scientists are corrupted.
pod over.
Thanks so much for being here, Ken.
And so it's a unique game in the fact that it's got like a tower defense feel to it as a cooperative game where you know, these horrors are coming down these six different tracks on the game board, and you're working with your group of characters. So unlike some cooperative games, you actually have you're using a whole team. So you have five standees on the board that you oversee. And every person, the five standees kind of make up a player's faction. And so the faction units standees are moved around the board to take all these different kinds of actions. And so the goal of the game is to survive. It's really a survival game where it's takes 9 rounds to play, and over the course of those 9 rounds you need to evacuate a certain number of civilians from Plum Island before kind of the island is completely taken over. You risk kind of this biohazard leak because as you are kind of fighting back these horrors, you're coming in and potentially getting you're like in close combat with them, and so you're potentially getting contaminated, and so you're kind of also pushing back this contamination level. And then there's a little bit of like supplies feed your people kind of a portion of the game too, where everybody kind of has to make it and like find the supplies they need to make it through the thing. Also all the while making sure that these horrors don't actually get off the island. So there's like a bridge that they can get off on, or they can get off if they get to the bottom of the island. There's all of these like rescue boats that are trying to get civilians off. And so if the horrors actually make it to the bottom, then kind of all kinds of chaos ensues. And so it's this pretty unique game in kind of a fairly well-trod trope, right? I mean, these are horrors, Ben, not zombies.
It's not zombies. It's concepts coming at you. It's like here comes a horror. A horror is coming at me.
Yes, a horror.
The concept of horror is coming at me. It's a terrible thing that's coming for you. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. A bad thing. It's coming. Yeah. So, you know, wink, wink, they're not zombies. But when I teach the game, even as the developer, and when the zombies are coming down.
Is it because you guys don't want to say zombie? Is it because it's like you don't want the zombie brand or something? Like not brand, but like if you don't want people to say, oh, it's a zombie game.
The lore of the game didn't really like make it feel the designer Herman was really intent on it feeling more like a, you know, biological real world accident. And so, you know, these like mutations and horrors, you know, kind of zombie adjacent. But
zombie adjacent
anyway.
That's a good answer. I mean, that makes sense. Like it's they're not because zombies are zombies. It's not like you don't call mummies zombies. Right. Zombies are zombies. And these are not zombies. These are just people who have been mutated by something terrible, and now they want to do terrible things to people, but they're not necessarily interested in eating brains. So
yeah, right? No, totally not.
So
that would never happen.
Not really zombies. Zombie-esque.
Yeah. So it's been fun. As a developer, I get a like kind of a pre-release copy where we're like checking everything that's kind of like the first 10 copies off of the print get air shipped to us, so we can like go through things and make sure that, you know, the components are all there and everything looks the way and nothing was miscut or whatever.
Yeah.
So I get an early copy of everything that I'm working on, and it's hit the table. I think I've had it like a little over a month. I think it's hit the table like 4 or 5 times.
Wow.
It's just something that's really fun to play with friends and family, and it's a really cool co-op puzzle. It feels very different, but it's got a lot of, it's like dripping with narrative. It's one of Herman's gifts as a designer, is he just brings a lot of flavor to it.
That's good.
But what's really unique about it is that it's got this very mainstream like theme on it, and it plays and it feels like a very mainstream cooperative game. However, the basis of it is a squad level war game. And so because the way that he's a war game designer by like, that's where all of his other like past designs are, except for he did a game called Dawn of the Zeds, one of his earlier games. And I think that's part of why this is the Plum Island Horror is like differentiating from that a little bit, because the Zs are, Z is for zombie, right?
Right.
And so, so it feels very different than that game. But because of his background in these kind of war games, the way in which you are moving your five standees around feels very much more like a tactical war game. And so like choosing where to combat the horrors matters a lot in how successful you can be.
Yeah.
Or, you know, choosing when to, you know, pull back, whether to push, and like kind of looking through different parts of the game. It feels like you're making a lot of like very interesting tactical decisions.
Maybe a gateway.
It's great. Lots of fun.
Maybe a gateway into that approach to games.
Totally. And it's not a very heavy game, but I would say it's like probably most adjacent in the cooperative space to something like Eldritch Horror. You know, okay. It's kind of got that like cooperative narrative feel. I would say as a very biased opinion, I would say that it feels a little bit more strategic than Eldritch Horror. So
okay.
Eldritch Horror seems to me to feel like a game where like I love it, played it a ton, but sometimes those mythos cards come up and they just kick you in the teeth and there's nothing that you can do about it.
Right.
You're like, well, you just can't prepare for that.
I've never played it actually, but okay. I feel I would imagine like you, I just can imagine
it's sentiment.
I can imagine
I've had, and
that's the sort of game where you play and then all of a sudden something very Lovecraftian and terrible happens to you and it all ends.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think it kind of brings in some of those like narrative beats that people really love in Eldritch Horror, but provides a much more strategic tactical space. So if you are kind of somebody who, you know, likes that Euro puzzle of like, I have 1,000 things I want to do and I have to figure out what I'm going to do right now.
I love doing that.
It's great. So, so I've been playing a lot of that. It's been really fun.
Yeah.
And that's coming, I think, in November. It starts shipping.
Oh,
so
it is November.
Sounds interesting at all.
It is November. It's happening now. It's going to be
It is November.
Later this month.
Yeah.
That's great.
Later
I love
month,
that.
Early December, maybe. Yeah,
you know, normally when people
I think right now you can, if you're interested, like it's still in the P500 stage, so you can still get it for that reduced P500 cost before it actually starts shipping. So there's this sweet window right now. If you're
sweet
interested.
Window. That's exciting because normally I feel like when people are like, when's that could be available? Like, oh, probably like Q1 of next year. I'm like, I get so mad, but you're like, might be happening this month or early next month. So okay.
Well, yeah, I was just thinking like you're right, because I know that it was supposed to get to our warehouse sometime mid-November, and then I was like, oh, it is mid-November. I wonder if I just haven't heard about it yet. Like, oh, they got there yet. So
it's on your doorstep.
Fingers crossed, delivery before Christmas.
Okay,
but
that's good.
You never
know
with the shipping world.
Yeah, that's true. I feel like I'm like an infomercial. It's like, wow, coming this month? What? But wait, there's more. So a game that I played on Friday, I played a game called Arborea. I think it's Arborea. I'll pull up the designers because I'll actually be a responsible, podcast host. I actually can't find it. I know I was just, oh, there it is. So this game designed by Danny Garcia. Interesting game. It's put up by Alley Cat Games, and I'm mentioning Alley Cat Games for a reason in just a moment. I knew this is another one I knew very little about. I feel like I just wasn't paying attention to Essen Games or whatever, but this is just showing up. The theme of it is very kind of like, feels kind of Miyazaki forest. Mysticism,
okay.
Fantasy, pretty cool. Okay. You know, like it sort of took me to a little bit of a Botoku space and the art and everything.
Okay, sure.
And but I was the little wisps that I heard about it was that it kind of played with some of the concepts that we got in Zolkin, which is Zolkin is like the classic game where you put your people onto gears. And then you ride those gears and there's a lot of decision on when do you put people on? When do you pull people off? When you pull people off, you get rewards, etc. So this is what I was talking about before about how I'm playing sequencing games, because like evacuation is all about sequencing.
Gotcha.
This one's all about sequencing.
Interesting.
And so in
maybe
this
it's having
game,
a moment.
Sequencing is hot right now. Sequencing is the new trick taking.
Sequences. You heard it here, folks. You heard it here.
Breaking news on Game Brain. But so this game, what happens is that it doesn't have gears, but there are like these different action areas that have little, it looks like people movers at the airport. Like on your turn, you put a meeple, you put a meeple onto a conveyor. It's essentially a conveyor belt. I don't know what the game calls it. It's not my copy, so I don't have the, I didn't look through the rules. I don't know the actual name for these things, but it's like a path. And you go on the, you put like one or two meeples on paths or, you know, and then you slide the path forward. And then it's like a piece of cardboard. And essentially then someone else puts something on the path on their turn and they slide it forward. So you're sort of like, your meeple gets like pushed forward. It's essentially the same effect as a gear, just not nearly as cool. And then eventually you step off on your turn, or maybe even on someone else's turn, you can step off of this moving platform. I was actually kind of upset that the theme wasn't like subway or like public bus, because it kind of reminded me a lot of that, you know, like you get on and then you're like, oh, this is my stop. I'm going to get off, you know? So you get up, when you get off, your meeple goes down this, like, then goes down, my friend called it a walkabout. I don't know if it's actually called a walkabout in the rules, but your meeple goes on the walkabout, as is wont to happen.
And it looks like they're called pilgrimages in the rules.
They go on a pilgrimage. But anyway, okay. You walk down a path. And so obviously the longer you stay on the little people mover, your path will have better and better rewards. And so you like, that's sort of like the central thing that's going on there, much like Zulkin. There are some interesting things going on in this game. When on your turn, a lot of the paths generate resources. So maybe I wish I could tell you what the resources were. There's like cherry blossoms. I remember cherry blossoms, sure. Things like that. So let's say I go down a path and I generate like 3 cherry blossoms. I could then use those cherry blossoms to fulfill a contract. But if I don't use them, they kind of like exist in a kind of a public space where other people could use the cherry blossoms on their turns. So if you basically elect not to use the resources that you generate, you will usually make points off that. So there's sort of an economic shared incentive thing going on. Like, hey, I can make these resources and I could use them, or maybe I won't use them and just get points. And then maybe someone else will use them. It's pretty cool. And then as you're playing the game, like one of the things that happens is, like, as I go down the path, a creature appears in this one area, and like there's like a little bit of a creature market, and you wanna acquire creatures into your personal player area because you have these. This is just it's so funny as I'm describing it. This game sounds a little all over the place, but these contracts that you get. That you're using resources to fulfill, when you fulfill the contracts, you get some rewards, and then you turn the card over, and it's like a 2x3 grid. Like visually, think of some of the player boards from Smartphone Inc. Like it looks like that.
Okay, sure.
And they have different terrains on them, and these creatures that you're getting, you want to put them into this like garden that you're growing, because you put the cards together. You create a garden of these grids, and you want to align up the different terrains in certain ways. That way, if you put a cat on certain terrains, it's going to score really well at the end of the game. And then certain animals score really well if there's another animal that's in a horizontal line. There's all sorts of stuff. Really cool stuff in this game, but it left me cold. I have to say it left me cold in my first play. Because it felt like it was one of these games where the sum was not greater than the parts. Is that the expression? It just felt like cool concepts, but servicing kind of a pedestrian game. Like love the people mover, love this interesting resource thing, but ultimately it's just in service of fulfilling contracts and doing like a little spatial game, and that. Was not exciting to me ultimately, and the game state is very volatile. The things are I played at 5 players, so maybe that's part of it.
Okay,
but like the resources are like you see a resource like, oh look, there's 3 waters, I'm gonna take them. Oh, they're gone. Oh, there's 3 cherry blossoms, I can do this contract. Oh, they're gone. Oh, there's that. Oh, it's gone. It's like one of those games, and it kind of like. At first, I was like, this is so cool. There's so much going on. There's so much variability. This is lots happening. But I found that like midway through, I started to get bored, and then it started to become tedious. So I think Arborea is not going to be one for me. But other people at the table seem to like it. No one seems to love it. They seem more interested in trying it. I will say this is the real bone to pick. And this is why I mentioned this from Alley Cat Games. It's like almost impossible to read the board. There are icons everywhere and they are tiny, teeny, teeny, tiny.
Mm.
And this drove me nuts because the box size is sort of smaller. And I feel like this board needed to be larger just to be able to use it. And there's lots of empty space on the board that's filled with this like very big, bold, brash kind of really cool art. But then you can't see any of the icons. And I just have to say to people out there designing games, artists, graphic design matters. Okay. It really matters. And please don't do this. And Alley Cat Games, they put out Autobahn last year, which was, I think, a top three game for me last year. It's really, really cool economic shared incentive game. And everything in that game was tiny and hard to read because, again, they were going for a smaller box. And, you know, Alley Cat Games, you gotta do better. I'm sorry. I know it's a way to save money. And maybe you have some insight, Ken, because you're on the business side of this. But, like, I understand you got to save money and create margins, but like when it's really small, when stuff is really small and like it's small in the fingers and it's small to read, it really gets in the way. Like it actually hamper a game. And I wonder if actually some of my experience was affected by the fact that there was a usability issue. So I don't know. Is that totally possible? I mean, how much when you see a game, Ken, that has like lots of small icons and stuff like that, do you think like, oh, okay, I know why this is. I know what's going on here.
I mean, there's a lot of things, right? I mean, there's so many things that it could be, you could take into consideration. One of the weirdest things about games that have come out in the last 4 or 5 years is that a lot of games have been played and developed and designed in a digital space. Mm-hmm. And so when you can zoom in on a board all you want, you don't care how big something is, right? And so I just had a meeting with one of my graphic design layout guys working on a map for a game that's coming out probably next year because it's not right now. But, you know, I like sent the prototype map over. And at GMT, we have we work with one factory and the factory does specific board sizes. So all of our boards are dimensionally the same, effectively. We can choose how many panels we have on our boards, up to 8 panels. But whether it's a 4-panel board or a 6-panel board and 8-panel board, the panels are all the same size. And so we only have like 4 or 5 different ways that we can put a board together. And so I was meeting with him and I had sent him this prototype and the whole game had been done in Tabletop Simulator. And he's like, this doesn't fit. We need a bigger board. And I was like, come on, this is the board size that I got, you know, this is what we put on our cost list. And so he's like, it's not happening. It's like, if you want everything on here like this, it's just not going to fit. And so we ended up going up in board size and it worked out because we had actually ended up changing some components through playtesting. So we cut a couple components that we ended up changing to some tracks at lots of things like that happened in playtesting. But lo and behold, it was fine. I just like barely got it okay by our production person to you're like, she was like, you are just within budget. I was like, whew, okay, we're fine. But it's a real consideration. I mean, and it comes down to the factory that you're working with. It comes down to, you know, where and how the game was developed and playtested. And sometimes, you know, you just kind of have to, you have to go with something for cost. And, you know, and one of the hard things as a publisher that you have to kind of come to terms with is, you know, it's like, well, we really want all of this in the game. But we also want it to be at a price point that people are going to purchase, you know, and things are getting more expensive all the time. And I mean, wood is so expensive in board games right now. And so it's come down a little bit, but man, it like hit the very tops that we've ever seen it in 2022, end of 21 through 2022, started coming down in 2023. Yeah. And so, you know, and you think about that, but we don't always think about that as a consumer, what that does to all of the cost of the game, yeah. right? So at some point, we also like, you know, I think board games are slowly getting more expensive. People are slowly expecting a little bit of inflation in prices. But you have to you make decisions, you know, at some yeah. point. It's like, well, we also want people to buy our game, right? Because we know it's a good game. And so, you know, where do we have to make production decisions so that we can actually get a game out? So I have no idea. Like, I have not talked to anybody at Alleycat. I have no idea, you know, how they go about it. I don't know what factory they use. There's so many things. I don't want to yeah. try and speak for them. I mean, but those are some of the things that I have to be aware of.
Yeah, I do feel like a little bad, right? Because it's like, Alleycat games do better. But like, if they are genuinely just trying to keep the price point down, like, I can't be that mad. But at the same time, like, there's gotta be a happy medium. And with Arboria, it was just too small. And we were, you know, we at the table were constantly looking at different parts of the board. We're like, it's nice that they have this art here. We did not need this art. Like, this is a space where we could rethink these tracks, make them a little bit more visually like usable, like a little cleaner. And like, I actually really loved the art. When I saw the board, it was like a very busy board, but sometimes busy can work, oddly enough.
Right.
The board for Praga Cup at Regni, I absolutely love. I saw this, it was busy, but I was like, it was like inviting busy. And, but then ultimately, because the icons were so small and hard to read, I then got frustrated because it's like, you made a busy board,
right?
And then you made it hard to read when you actually needed to play a game. So that bothered me. But ultimately, yeah. you know, it's just the game. It just, I felt like really cool stuff in there that maybe some people will absolutely love. But for me, I felt yeah. like it was in service of kind of like, it didn't have like an epic scope or anything. Like Zolkin has a scope. Like Zolkin feels big. Right. It feels epic. When you're done with Zolkin, you're like, whoo, I did it. Like I got through it, you know? And I think because maybe there's a tech tree in Zolkin. Maybe I love tech trees. Maybe that's why. But like, I feel like there's an escalation in Zolkin that's very exciting. And I felt like with this one, it was like, okay, go down the path. Okay, got some resources. Oh, got an animal. Okay, and here's the contract. And I got my garden out. And now let's do it all over again. And, you know, you get, there's other elements. There are other systems in the game. It's not just that. And there's ways that you can get additional perks as you play. So you get more and more perks, little things. So anyway, I was hoping that would be better than it was, but it was a miss for me. The last thing, I just want to say one last thing, because we've got to go soon. But yesterday, Ken, I had an epic day of playing 1880 China, or is it just 1880?
No, baby.
1880, which has really become one of my favorites. China. One of my favorites. But I have a question for you. So you're 18XX. Like, you're part of the famed Seattle 18XX players, right? Like, you know the genre. Okay.
Fringe. I'm fringe.
You're fringe.
I'm fringe with them. They're really hardcore and amazing, a group of players, and they meet every Saturday like clockwork. They're so committed, and I have had the opportunity to play with them a few times.
They're very lucky. So, you know, when I play 18XX with my friends down here in LA, like, we sort of have a, like, well, not, we have played with different groups, but like with one group, we have kind of like a more casual approach to the game. And we really just like, we play and we just sort of like ride the wave. Okay. This is all to
ride
say
the wave. Okay.
People online say, oh, you know, 1880, I don't know. How long does 1880 take for you, Ken? 6 hours, 7 hours?
You know, because I time every one of my games, because I'm one of those people, I'll just tell you, my average game time for 1880 is 4 hours and 45 minutes.
Yes. Okay. I'm glad you said that. This is going to be a no judgment zone. I'm telling you to not have judgment.
Okay. No judgment. No judgment.
This is a judgment. Well, when I played 1880, we talked about it on the podcast, or I talked about it on Candace's podcast. We played, I think it was like a 12-hour game. I think it was 12 or 13 hours, maybe 14 hours, okay? Yesterday, okay. we started in earnest at like 1:15, and we finished at 2:30 in the morning. We play our games. we play, so now admittedly, there was like a 90-minute break in the middle. there was like dogs had to get walked. Sure. You know, there was some stuff.
Yeah, I mean, when you're 12 hours, you got to do some of that stuff.
So our games go really, like, we take a long time. I guess maybe we have a lot of banter. Maybe there's a lot of decisions. Maybe it's because, like, is it maybe, like, as you become... I've played a lot of 18xx games. Okay, I've played, like, I've got, like, 80 under my, you know, on 18xx.games, which was funny because when we did playtesting, you're like, there was tears. Like, how would you describe yourself? Experienced, like, it was sort of like me, like dabbling your toe in it, as in you've played, you know, between like 50 and 100 games. I'm like, I guess I'm just dabbling my toe in it, but I have questions. Sure. I have questions about, like, sure, why are your games more at a manageable length? I'm not gonna ask why are mine slow because you haven't seen the games, but like, why are your games? It's crazy. I need advice about something. But first I need to know, how are you playing 1880 in 5 hours, basically? 4 to 5 hours.
So it's a good question, right?
I mean, how do you do this?
So it's funny because I think the opposite. I think, how does it take you 12 hours? I just can't imagine a world where 1880 takes 12 hours. So we're on opposite sides of the spectrum here, Ben. And here's the thing. I'm the kind of person who, that still sounds like an amazing day to me.
I'm not a person who,
yeah, I'm sure. And that's the thing. Like, part of it is the people, right? Like, sometimes you just don't care. You know, you're like, hey, man, I feel so blessed to be able to hang out with my friends for 12 hours. And if we play one game or no games, mm-hmm, or 10 games, I don't care. So that's the caveat that I'll give. However, there are people who 18xx games, they just don't believe that the time on the box is actually what people like can actually play the game in. And so I mean, you get some of the very stereotypical like advice, like, first of all, and I'm pretty sure you guys use poker chips, right?
We do use poker chips. Yes. We use poker chips.
Okay, good. I mean,
we got a revenue tracker. We got everything.
Okay. So those are like, so you have the play rates, as I call them.
Yes.
So that makes the time faster for sure. Because if you've never played a game with paper money, man, if you guys take 12 hours without it, you would, that's a 24 hour game for you.
No, paper money, I will never. I think we just take a long time making decisions. Maybe we like really tease out decisions.
So, but here's a real question. How many people were there?
There were five people.
Five people. Okay. So that's just like, that's right on the cusp for 1880. So one of the things that you always have to think about when you think about any kind of 18xx game is you have to think about the exponential nature of think time that comes with, right, the number of companies in a game. So I don't play 1880 with less than six people, because in my opinion, there's too many companies in the game for less players than that. Because on average, generally speaking, as kind of a rule of thumb, I think players generally have the faculty to strategically think through two to three companies worth of plays.
Mm.
And that's high end. Ideally, people are running one or two companies, ideally.
Yeah, and we all have
and
two
so,
companies.
Because,
except for one.
And you all have two companies.
Someone had a third one.
Right. And so, and what happens there is, and then what's really unique about 1880 is the way in which the companies they come in and they get put in a set order, right?
Yeah.
And so if you had one player with back-to-back companies, it's not the player's fault,
but it's actually
the fact that they're running back-to-back companies that you added an exponential amount of time. Because in 18xx, the way that you go from a long group play of a game to a short game is that you teach the other players that they are doing their turn on other players' turns.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, because one of the unique things about 18xx as kind of compared to so many other board games is that the game state doesn't really change that much in between operations. Maybe somebody like upgraded a tile that you use, and then you can just quickly upgrade your revenue track, right? That's mm-hmm. how you use that well, is you say, oh, I use that city. It went up 10. I moved my revenue tracker up 10. I don't have to rethink about how much like my train runs or whatever.
I think that's important. I think that's important. And I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think like
no, that's fine.
The revenue tracker, I feel like is so much more important than just like, we can just see how much things are doing. I think that's like, it actually could really move things along.
Right. And so one of the things that I did when I was, I ran a monthly game day for 18XX where I was literally teaching new people to come into the 18XX hobby because I love it. I think 18XX is one of the best subgenres of board gaming, but I know that it's hard for people to get into. And so one of the first things I say is like, no joke, if you're interested and you want to play, we'd love to have you, but bring a piece of paper, you know, because anytime you have to recalculate something, you're probably doing more work than you need to.
Go on. I'm gonna come back to that.
Okay. And so it's really tricky is when you said you had five players and you were each running two or three companies. So you're running between 10 and 12 companies in 1880. And that's standard. So that's why I don't play with less than six, because everybody has two companies. Nobody should have three companies in 1880. It's just too much. And so that's why I think six and seven is the best, because you have one person with one, you have a couple people with two. However, I'll say is, you know, and so some of it is training players to play well. It's a very different kind of game to play. And so people who play 18XX fast, you know, they have a way that they approach the game that feels very different. And so you can learn that. So like one of the things that I will teach people is, you know, bring a piece of paper, and as you get a train, you know, you write down your revenue, and as they increase, you just cross out a number along that line and you add the next number. Or if you want to, you can add to the end of your line so that you're never like having to trace your routes over and over again to try and figure out what the best one to run is. And that's what takes a long time in 18XX games, is when you have 12 companies running and you have to count 12 routes every operating round. I mean, that's going to take a long
time. Yes, because, okay, thank you for saying this, because this is what we're thinking about, because it was a long ass game. I mean, we were having great fun. But around 11:30, for as many hours as it was, it just flew by. When we looked down, we saw it was 11:30 p.m. Totally. We're like, oh, my God. But that was also the moment where we'd say, oh, my God, it's 11:30. And then it's almost like that the mental thing happens where then everyone starts to get tired. And I have found in both in-person games I played at the game, because I played it on online, et cetera. And I actually think it's a game that's really better to play in person than async on 18xx.games, because it's so much about timing. And I feel like if it gets dragged out over like many days or weeks, you sort of lose some of that crisp excitement of like, when's something going to happen?
Right.
So like, I really wanted to get it to the table. And I have found, like, you know, the arc of the game is as it goes through, once you get around the area where you'd normally have a train rush, that's like communism hits the game. And I have found that sort of like post-communism in the game, when you're entering, like you're in the browns and then the grays, that's when I feel like the game, like in both long games I had, that's when people were like most exhausted, and it was like calculating routes, and it was like, and what happens is you're tired, and so you calculate your route, and there's all these permutations, and you finally figure it out, and then I think like you're tired, and you're not paying attention, and then all of a sudden it's when it's your turn again, you're like, oh, I have to figure this out again, and you're like, right. I think there was a tile that was changed, but I don't remember if there was a tile. Was there a tile? Right. And I feel like the game, if we could figure out a way to sort of like power through and speed up that that last section there, so that way after communism, and now you're like, okay, after communism, there's like a vicious train rush moment. And then after that train rush, you're like, okay, now let's sprint to the end. I guess piece of paper and just track, I guess, would be really focused on what the changes are on your routes, right? I think that would probably speed it up a lot.
Well, So that's a big part of any 18xx game, right? So like the time factor in 18xx game is number of companies that need to run, and then times the variability of the board. So one of the things that you learn as you play a game over and over and over again is you know what revenue centers people want to hit on the map. Mm-hmm. Right. And so you don't have to go through and be like, is this five better than this five, better than this five? You can go, these are the top five spots on the board. Am I hitting them or am I not hitting them? And so, you know, and that is also something. So familiarity will make a game faster no matter where you are. But also, you know, and then it comes down to like the players, you know, how well the players trust one another and are willing to like do the work together, you know, and so.
And we do work all together to help each other find the routes.
Totally. But the question, like, when I'm teaching new people to play games, there's a few games that I always go to when I'm teaching people 18xx, because like I tend to be a person who thinks that you should have some 18xx experiences before you do too much exploration of the genre, because even though like 1880 is a fine game to start with, if it's your first game, you're gonna learn fine. But I wouldn't start you there. As definitely a person not. Who likes to bring people in, I wouldn't start somebody there. And so part of it though is like when I'm playing these games with new players or players who are unfamiliar with a title that I'm more familiar with, you know, I help them. I go, these are the high revenue centers, and so these are where we're going to count your train. And they'll be like, well, what about down here? Trust me, we don't need to count that. It's not as high as this.
Yeah.
You know, and at some point, you don't need to count the six permutations of a potential train. You just know, hey, these are the six, you know, these are the highest spots. Am I there or am I not there?
Right, which is what's good and about the also, express trains later in that game, where the express trains are kind of like, just choose your best route, you know? Best
exactly. And what's important to remember is most of the time people are running similar routes. So if somebody else is running this, if you can recognize that there's another company running the same route as you, then just use that work, right? Yeah. You've counted it, you're upgrading it together, and it's kind of like three birds, one stone kind of a situation, right?
Yeah.
So those are definitely things that will help, bring down play times.
Yeah, because it was that last chapter. It's like such a bummer because we were all having so much fun, but you can sort of see I had fun throughout the entire thing. I even liked the last chapter when I was exhausted. But people to leave, you know, it's like when you go to a restaurant, dessert matters. Like you want people, the last course they have to really matter. So I was just wondering if there were any like really good hacks, you know, beyond. You know, what we typically know, what we should be doing and everything. And I think it's just about, I guess it's funny because it's like you're really exhausted in that time for us and your eyes are glazing over. But that's almost a time when you have to be most vigilant, where we as a table say, hey, this tile, we just changed this tile. Did that affect, does this tile, was anyone's runs on this tile? Yes, it was. Yes, yes, yes.
Right.
Okay, everyone just move the revenue tracker up. And we just don't do that.
Right.
And like we waste so much time just calculating at
recalculating
the end,
you
know? But I have to say just one last thing about 1880. I mean, I love it, and I was just reflecting on one thing that's just so good about that game is the arc of that game is so smart. It's so smart. Like it basically says,
it's true,
like, hey, you're starting a company, here's some money. Oh, okay. And then like work towards, you know, getting to 50% by the threes, and then you can get some more money. And hey, okay, now work towards getting to your foreign investor. There's some more money. And then it's sort of like it's taking you from like money influx to money influx. But each one sort of like raises the stakes. The first one's just like, oh, buy some stocks. You can get this. The second one says, okay, like see how you can do the board work to get to where you need to be. And then the third one is kind of like, okay, you're in communism. You decide, are you going to take advantage of this and put money in your company? You're going to get some money into your hands. Like now it's like the game before was giving you money. Now it's like, do you have the skills to figure out your own money? And then after communism, it's like, okay, congratulations. We have taught you everything you need to know. And you're either going to sink or swim right now. It's because it's like then a brutal train rush. And then you like sort of emerge from the other side. And I think like, wow, that is actually like story-wise as like beats. That is a great, great arc. And it's sort of like, it sort of brings you up through this like incremental money like infusions of money until finally it says, okay, you're grown up, you're an adult now, and you got to find out how to live in the world. Good luck.
Oh, also, I hope that you can build tracks still.
Also, by the way, that four train that you just had to waste all your influx on, it's gone and you owe $1,000 to buy a train now.
Yeah, so good luck. Yeah, I'll say two more things just generally about 18XX and then we can call it. But I want to say that, first of all, it's also important to remember that that particular part of 18XX games, especially in some of the classic games, and by that part, I'm talking about the final phases of the game, which we call brown or gray, which is in reference to the color of the track tiles that are being laid traditionally. Yeah. They are just, because so many of these games tend to go to like a game break situation or a bank break situation, they're built to just run and run and run. And so the end game in some of these classic games, just broadly speaking, they just slow down by the way the game is built.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of an artifact of the genre. And so some of the smart new games are changing that. Right. And so, you know, it's just something to keep in mind is that a lot of new games are kind of changing end game because everybody's realizing that that's just the slow part of 18XX games. And so, you know, modern designers are saying, hey, we can do something about that. And then I'll say the last thing, which is it's very taboo. It's very taboo in much of board gaming to declare a winner before the end of the game.
Yeah.
It is very common in 18XX games because one of the things that's unique about 18XX games is that at most points in the end game, you can fairly easily look around the table and you can look at people's cash on hand and you can look at people's portfolios and you can compare them against one another and you can kind of say, I've got you beat here. Because in a little bit of like a checkmate situation where it's like, unless your company is, unless where you have a few more shares than me or have a few less shares than me is significantly outperforming what I've invested in, we are both going to increase at the same or very similar trajectories. And so it's what, and because there's so much open information in 18XX games, it is one of the few places in gaming where you can actually fairly accurately predetermine whether or not how something is actually going to come out.
I'm always nervous to do that. I'm nervous to do that because the first time I played 1880, the scores were separated by like $50.
Sure. And there's tons of those stories, right?
Yeah.
Like, and I'm not telling you like you shouldn't play games to the end, but sometimes you know. Sometimes you know, and sometimes actually knowing who wins isn't worth the next 2 hours of play.
That there is the real takeaway. That is a fair assessment. Knowing who wins, does it really matter? Because sometimes it really is just about like just weathering the storm, and then once you've gotten through the train rush, I still like that great time. I like having my big trains and getting stuff.
I do too.
It's so fun. It's a great release, but you're right.
It's just important. Like at some points, it's just important to remember that sometimes it's worth just calling it, you know? And because what's crazy is, so you talk about, if I have a train game day and I often will play for 12 or more hours, usually we start at like 9 or 10 in the morning and we play till midnight. I usually play three games. I usually play three.
Get out, games. Ken. Stop that. Being outrageous right now.
No, I do. I'm not doing it just because I want to play. I mean, I'm not like there to play three games, but it's very common that we get three games played. And for my time, you know, and like, I love the big day, one game all day days. But sometimes it's just fun to see it play out again.
Yeah.
And get a second chance at it, or at it, or at it, or see something else with the same allotted amount of time. And so sometimes the question is, do we call this game because we have a fairly good idea of who's winning and we get to play again? or play a different title. Sometimes that seems a little bit more worth it to me than like, well, let's count these routes for 2 hours. So it's just also something to keep in mind.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing. Like, that's why, honestly, when I have 80 games under my belt, but I feel like there's still so much to learn about just the act of playing these games. And I also like playing them online is way different than playing them in person. There's like, I think there is a learning curve to playing in person. But that being said, let's not make this podcast as long as the gray phase on an 18XX game, okay? You've got a baby.
Nice.
You've got a baby, and you need to treasure your time while your baby is asleep.
That's right.
So
if I don't
much.
Get sleep now, I'm never going to get it.
Yeah, thanks so much for spending this precious free time that you have here on the podcast. It was so fun to reconnect and talk about these games and learn about the games you've been playing and learn about the games that you guys over there at GMT have coming down the pike. Really appreciate you. Is there anything you want to plug beyond this, like social media or anything like that, or anything, or just tell people where they can get games, or I don't know. Is there, you want to plug something? You feel like plugging
well,
something?
I mean, what am I going to plug? I'm not much of a plugger. It's not really my nature. But if you want to connect with me and you want to talk to me about games, you can find me on Twitter. My little, I don't know what it's called, tag or
handle.
Screen name or
Twitter. What is
is
that? I didn't know handle. That was a platform.
Thank you. Oh yeah, is X. It, it's called X now.
Yeah,
you know, it was not X when I had a baby, and that's about how connected I feel to the world of social media at this point. But if you want to get me there, my handle on X is my last name, Kuhn, Kuhn, Ken, Ken. So Kuhn, Ken. Drop me a note. I love to talk games. And that's the best way to get a hold of me. And you know, and if you want to try 18XX game set in the Pacific Northwest, have a game, 1822 PNW. Yeah,
as you all should. Thank you so much, Ken, for being here. Thanks everyone for listening. You've been listening to Game Brain, produced and edited by Matthew Robinson, Tom Donnelly, Trey Alsop, and Ben Mandelker. Special thanks to Daedalus for our incredible music. More on Daedalus at gamebrainpod.com. And thanks to Edamar Peleg for our incredible graphics. Be sure to check him out on Instagram at Kerbuloni or on his website, kerbuloni.com. You can reach us by email at contact@gamebrainpod.com. Thanks for listening, and go play some games with friends, or make some friends with games.